Back in the year 1940, speaking of Europe, in 1940, the military of Britain was fighting the wiles of Adolf Hitler and the German army. They were trapped in the Panzer Division. The Panzer Division was trapped in Dunkirk. I don't know if you know where Dunkirk is. I don't know if you're familiar with this account or not. But on one side was the German army, and on the other side was the water. And the German army had just about engulfed the British army and the British navy that were trying to fight the battle. And it looked as if a certainty had occurred that Germany would win a great battle. But for some reason, Adolf Hitler paused. I don't know if it was to bring in more troops. I don't know if it was to perform a sneak attack. But there was a message sent back to Britain from one of the people that was in charge of the British Navy and the British soldiers. The message that went back said simply, we are surrounded on all sides. The battle will be severe. There will be many losses. We may not survive. And then the last three words of that message was, but if not. And the message ended. In Britain, when the message came, there was a concerted effort made by the British government to solicit and to enlist and to demand everyone that had any type of sailing vessel that was at least 30 feet long to meet at a certain place and head to Dunkirk. There were fishing boats. There were yachts. There was lean-tos, there was anything that would float, and to Dunkirk they went. And in one day, the impossible was accomplished. Every Briton that was in the web of Hitler, and every Briton that was fearful that day for his life, was removed in anything that would float. And the arms that the British Navy had were left to be surprised by the Germans when they found nobody home. In one day, every British sailor that was in Dunkirk was safely returned to Britain in a makeshift mismatch rescue operation. Not one person was lost. It was, to some who study these type things, it was the turning point in the war. And the turning point occurred because faith is tested in adversity. I want you to understand, though, how faith was tested in this adversity. The message that was sent back to Britain was a message that might be intercepted by anyone, most especially the enemy. And so there was a coded message sent. And the coded message that was sent was, but if not. And you see, the person that sent the message knew enough to write the message in such a way to tell the people of an impending doom and to tell the people about a very small likelihood of success or even survival. When the message came back to Britain, those three words changed the course of history. And the way they chose to change the course of history was that the one that received the message knew what those words meant. And he knew that what the sender was telling him was, we will not bow to Hitler. We will not surrender. We might all die, but we will die fighting. The reason that they knew that was because of where those words had been spoken earlier. The book of Daniel. Daniel is under the captivity of Nebuchadnezzar. And the reason he has found success with Nebuchadnezzar and been elevated more than just somebody that is a captive is because of what he had done for him. But the expression, what have you done for me lately, comes to play here because Nebuchadnezzar turns on Daniel. Maybe without recognizing it, but he institutes a decree that says, when certain things happen, that all will bow to the golden image that's in his honor. And Daniel says, we will not bow. Nebuchadnezzar responds to him in a rather cryptic manner and says to him, who's going to save you? The response that Daniel gives is that his God would save. But then Daniel says in Daniel the 3rd chapter in verse 18, something that sets Nebuchadnezzar on the sharpest edge of his anger. He will rescue us. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your God, or worship the golden image that you have set up. Daniel told him about his faith, and then Daniel told him about his conviction. I believe God will save us. But if he doesn't, that's okay too. Because no matter what, we will not bow. We will not serve your God, and we will not worship the golden image. The amazing thing to me about this story that occurred in 1940 is that the person that read the message that was sent back to England knew what the sender was telling him. Now, I don't want to ask you to raise your hands, but when we started this sermon, did you know where those three words came from? But if not. And did you know the message that was being relayed through those three words? It is amazing to me that as secular a world as we live in, and as secular as England has become, that less than 100 years ago, that there were two people in the British Navy that knew how to communicate a message with those three words that brought about a saving of those that were in darkness. The king didn't really like Daniel's attitude. He said, listen, this is not an option. Now, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hand. Daniel said, our God is able to deliver. We sing a song in the songbook that sometimes I think that we forget that most of these songs originated with verses 279. Because the grandest theme through the ages rung. The grandest theme for a mortal tongue. Because the grandest theme that the world e'er sung, our God is able to deliver. And that's what Daniel told the king. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand. Turn over to the book of 2 Peter with me, if you will. Because sometimes I believe that people have gotten to the point, and the reason that we've gotten to this point is because we don't think God really deals in the affairs of men today. And there's a reason we don't think that. We tell people that God was active in the Old Testament because he was trying to bring about the New Testament. He was trying to lead the people from where they were to where they ought to be. He was trying to bring Christ into the world so this Christ could be a schoolmaster that led the Jews, or the law could be, excuse me, the law could be a schoolmaster that led the Jews to Christ. And then in the New Testament, we see all the miracles and the signs and the wonders, and yet we end up in 1 Corinthians 13, where those times will come to an end. Can you imagine the majesty of recognizing that in your lifetime you saw spiritual gifts came into being, and then you saw them leave because the Word had been completed? We think it's something to go from color televisions, from black and white, to the internet, to satellite, to being able to find the sermon I left at home. I don't know that there was anything like what those people in the first century of the church saw. But in 2 Peter 2, I want to read to you, beginning in verse 4. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, cast them into hell, and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment. And if he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a creature of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, and if God condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, the righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. Well then, the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation. And the Lord knows how to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment, especially those who indulge the flesh in corrupt desires. If you don't have something to mark that verse in your Bible, reach over to the person next to you and get something to mark it with. Our God would be able to deliver Dan, but Peter says he's still able to deliver you. Peter says here, if he rescued Lot, if he rescued all these people, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation. Now, please don't misunderstand this. It's not like a bungee cord salvation, that the Lord will just let you jump so far and then he'll snatch you back. Sometimes we get the idea that Christianity is kind of like a force field, that it's going to keep everything away from us. That's not how God rescues people. In 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, in verse 13, another passage that you ought to know emphatically, the writer there reveals that there is no temptation that has overtaken man except that which is common to man. You remember the other night we talked about God will understand my situation? 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 knocks that one out of the park. And I know this is hard for us to accept sometimes, but there's nothing that's ever going to happen to you in your lifetime that happened to somebody else before you. And probably a whole bunch of somebody else's. You don't get to stand up and say, nobody knows the trouble I've seen. One of my grandchildren had a t-shirt that said, "No, no, nobody knows the trouble I've been." Probably a lot of us could wear that t-shirt. But we get this idea that somehow we've got it worse than anybody else. And you know what God says about that? What you've got is common. You go to the doctor and you're dying. Women will appreciate this. A woman gets a cold and she keeps going on and doing all that she's supposed to do, and man gets a cold and he's put in a sling. Preferably not by his wife. But have you ever gone to the doctor and you knew you were dying? I mean, you just knew something was bad wrong, and he looked at you and he said, what you have is a common cold. And what you wanted to say is, look, okay, I may have a cold, but ain't nothing common about this cold. I've got the worst cold that anybody's ever had. No, you don't. And you know why God's able to deliver us? The reason God's able to deliver us, because he knows what all the sins are. And he knows how to deliver us. And he knows that as loud as we cry and kick and scream, what we've got common. It's common to everybody. And I'll tell you right now that that's not the way that we think. And God's not going to deliver anybody from thinking they've been oppressed more than anybody else in the world. He's already told us. It's common. There'll be a way of escape, but you have to take it. You have to take the way of escape. He's not going to push you down the hall to get there. And then, Luke 16, turn over that passage just for a moment. Luke 16 and verse 25. This is the depiction of the Hadean world. And the rich man and Lazarus have died, and they've gone into the Hadean world, and the rich man is in torment in the Hadean world, and Lazarus is in Abraham's bosom, and then there's a great gulf, a great space in between them. Verse 25, after the rich man has asked Abraham to send Lazarus where he could dip the tip of his finger in water and touch it upon his tongue, he tells him there's a great gulf. And in verse 25, he says, but Abraham said, child, remember that during your life you received your good things. Likewise, Lazarus bad things. But now he's being comforted. And you're an enemy. You see, what God's saying there about Lazarus is this. Yeah, he had it rough. He received bad things. Not anything that's uncommon. But he endured those things and now he's being comforted. And here's the point that I want to make from Luke 16, verse 25. If the totality of your life is misery, if the totality of your life is agony, and you endure it, and in your dying breath, you say, oh, I'm glad this is over. What you're going to receive is so much better than anything you dreamed of. It will have all been worthwhile. I remember in 1984, I went to San Diego. I'd never been to San Diego before. When I got to San Diego, I called my friend Steve McDonald. And I said, Steve, you'll never guess where I am. He said, you're in San Diego. I said, okay, that was too easy. I said, you're never going to guess where I am in San Diego. He said, you're at the Hilton Hotel. And I said, okay, let me tell you this. You're guessing all the right answers. I said, I'm in the bathroom of the Hilton Hotel in my room. And there was a long pause on the other end of the phone. And I said, you know what? There is a telephone in the bathroom. And he said, uh-huh. I said, but that's not it. There's a color TV in the bathroom next to the telephone. And he said, shut up. I said, no, it's right, that's right. And you know what Steve said? He said, you've gone to heaven. Now, he's being funny. But I'll tell you what, I've never seen a bathroom that had marble floors. I've never seen a bathroom that had a, I didn't even tell him about the jacuzzi. I didn't want purple. It had a color television, a telephone, a jacuzzi, and marble floors. I spent the whole trip in the bathroom. And I tell you that story for this reason. I want you right now to use your imagination. Think of the greatest thing you've ever known in this earth. And then multiply it by the biggest number that you know how to multiply it by. And then understand this. The half has not been told. You can't comprehend heaven. And it's only for one reason. Because you can't comprehend God. And the reason you can't is because we're in a mortal body and God is spirit. And those that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and truth. I still remember that bathroom. I remember the first time I walked in there and I remember yelling Cindy as loud as I could yell. Can you imagine what it's going to be like to enter into heaven? There's no sin that's overcome you. There's no temptation that's overcome you. But such as is common to man. No matter how many bad things you have in this life, comfort is in the life to come. Daniel said, we will not bow. Our God is able to deliver. But see, there was really only two options. One was, God will deliver us, or the second option, He will not deliver us. And Daniel says, both of those are possibilities. And the king calls the biggest men that there are, ties them up the tightest that they can be tied, and they're thrown in the fiery furnace. And as they're thrown in, cry comes again from Daniel, we will not. We will not serve your gods. We will not worship the golden image that you've set up. And now faith is refined by fire. You see, always in the refining process, impurities are burned out so that what is real can stand the test of fire. And the king looks at the fire that's been heated up to the highest heat that it can be heated to. And the king stands in amazement. Did we not cast three men out in the fire? But I see four men, unbound, walking. And one looks like a son of God. Nebuchadnezzar calls for them to be brought out. There are three that are brought out. Their hairs are not singed. Their clothes are not bothered. And this is the greatest line in Daniel 3 in verse 27. No smell of fire was upon them. The reason that's the best line, the best thing that Nebuchadnezzar could have ever said is this. You ever go somewhere and you're out all day, and then you come home, and somebody that's been at home goes, have you been around somebody that's been smoking? No. Well, you smell like smoke. And my wife has a nose that can smell smoke at 20 yards. And she'll say, you've been around somebody that's been smoking. And sometimes I can go back and figure that out. Yeah, I was pumping gas. There was a guy that was standing next to me. He was smoking a cigarette. We almost blew up. But sometimes I can't. What I want to tell you about that is how impressed Nebuchadnezzar is. They don't even smell like smoke. And Nebuchadnezzar answers Daniel and says, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, the servants who trusted in him. And they set aside the king's command, and they yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god but their own. I want you to draw a circle around Daniel 3 and verse 28. And on the outside of that circle, I want you to write Revelation 2 and verse 10. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Listen to what Nebuchadnezzar said. They trusted him. They set aside, they ignored the king's command. And they yielded up their bodies, and they would not serve any god except their God. And a king changes his mind and issues a new edict that anybody that will not serve the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut into pieces. Now, when I was a kid and I misbehaved, my mother asked me, do you want me to beat the tar out of you? And I always said no, because that just in and of itself, that statement was scary. I didn't know I had tar in me. So I thought that was the worst thing I'd ever heard until Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come along, and Nebuchadnezzar says, if you don't serve their God, I'll cut you into pieces. That's how impressed he is with these. And you say, yeah, but that's not possible today. Everything's impossible till it's done. Everything's impossible till the moment comes where you have to choose. You have to choose. And you choose either to obey or disobey. Because the only two options after that are he either will deliver you or he won't. And oh, by the way, there has no temptation overtaken man but such as is common to man. There was somebody else besides Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that had to face this kind of a test? Absolutely. And there still is today. Matthew 10:28, Jesus says this, do not fear those that can kill the body, cannot kill the soul, but rather fear them who can kill both body and soul in hell. It's amazing what we choose to be afraid of. It's utterly amazing what we choose to be afraid of. They'll think I'm a Bible thumper. Woo! Isn't that scary? Well, they'll make fun of me. Let me tell you something.
They'll make fun of you anyway. Well, they'll think I'm weird. I won't get an advancement in the company. Let me ask you a question. If you're working for a company where being a Christian and living like a Christian is a detriment to you, why are you working in that company? Oh, you can't tell people what to do. I didn't. I just asked you a question. Why are you working in that company?
Because they pay pretty good. Well, boy, they better pay great. Because the rich man got his good while he's here on the earth, and now he was being paid with retribution. Daniel summed it up. He saved Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, and indirectly a British kingdom. Our God will deliver us. But if not, we will not bow. We will not serve. We will not worship your image. We're going to close now. We've lived in the world for the last several years, since about 2001, but actually before that, where there's a group of people who claim to be religious in their nature that sometimes will go into a place, maybe a coffee shop, maybe a market, and will ask people if they are Muslim or Christian. If they acknowledge that they are Christian, they will be shot, sliced, killed somehow immediately. If they say they are Muslim, they must recite a verse from the Quran. If they can do those two things, they will live. Or, if they will renounce Christ and Christianity and accept Allah, they can live. Somebody said, yeah, but this is America. One of the largest populations of Muslims is in Dearborn, Michigan. My family lives a few miles from there. And they're afraid. I want to tell you something. There is no temptation that is not common to man. What if somebody said to you, you can live if you will renounce Christ? What would you do? Do you know what the government advises people to do? Renounce Christ and live, and then you can do whatever you need to do after that to fix it all up. Well, they didn't get that from Daniel. We will not bow. We will not serve. We will not worship. And if God doesn't save us, that's okay. And there's one other question. What if that message had been sent to Britain today? Would have anybody understood what those three words meant? If it had been sent to you, would you have? The invitation of Christ Jesus is pretty simple. He asks you to make him your master. And he asks you to be ready to give answer for the hope that abides within you. Daniel's hope was, we will not bow. Our God is able to deliver. But if he doesn't, we will still do what's right. I know that's an awesome challenge. I know the difficulty that comes with that type of servitude. But I also know that we better start telling people about that type of servitude, because faithfulness does not consist of coming to church four times a week. Daniel displayed the fortitude of faithfulness that says, be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Oh yeah, we were created in God's image. His ways are higher than our ways, and His thoughts than our thoughts. And He's not like us. He tells us to become like Daniel. He tells us to become like Him. That's the invitation of Christ. We sing a song, I'm pressing on the upward way, new heights I'm gaining every day. Still praying as I onward bound, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. Have you got up on the same rung with Daniel yet? If not, when you go home tonight, bow your head and your heart and thank God that you have another day to climb another rung. Would you come to Christ? But if not, what would you do for eternity? You make that decision while we stand in line.